Technology.ie number 59.
Technology.ie is brought to you by Ireland's premier hosting and domain registration company, Black Knight. Black Knight offer a comprehensive range of hosting and domain solutions for businesses of all shapes and sizes, no matter where they are in the world.
Brought to you by Black Knight, it's the Technology.ie podcast, episode 59 from March 29th, 2013, with Michaela Nealon and Conor Muinichoy. Hello and welcome to Technology.ie. It's another podcast with Conor Muinichoy in the Edgecast Media Studios. And in Carlo, it's Michaela Nealon, CEO of Black Knight. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Con.
How are you?
Not too bad.
Good. It's been a while, I think 2 or 3 weeks since we've done a podcast. Where have you been? What have you been doing?
Oh, dear God. You would have asked me that, wouldn't you? let me actually check. Where have I been?
You're just back from Brussels, I think.
I've been to Brussels twice, and I was in London. Where else have I been? I'm not sure now. I'm trying to actually think.
Anything exciting happening out there in the world?
No, not really. I mean, there's a few things. I was over in Brussels last week for the Alliance for Safe Online Pharmacies meeting. Because it's one thing we're getting quite involved with is combating fake pharma online.
Mm, that's right. Then
I was in London for a couple of days working on a replacement for Who Is. And then I was over in Brussels for the .eu Registrar Advisory Board meeting.
Which you're the chair of?
Yes.
Okay, how did that go?
That was good. Good, constructive. We meet about three times a year, and we discuss various things with the .eu registry. So, you know, they might say, you know, hey, we're thinking about doing X. Do you think this is a good idea or a bad idea? And we'd come back. Or other times we might go to them and say, look, you know, it would be good if the XYZ was available, or if something was possible, because, you know, this is something that other registries are doing, or it's something that our clients are asking for. And, you know, it's good because, you know, you're having a proper dialogue with a registry operator, and it's a case of, you know, they're actually listening to what the market wants.
And where did the idea come from to put the .eu website in URID? How do you say it? URID. The URID to make it available in Irish.
Well, they make this site available in all the official languages of the European Union.
Very good. You just sent me a link to the Irish version of it there this evening. Very impressive.
Yeah, they were laughing about it, saying, you know, it's probably the most expensive translation that they have to do is the one into Irish.
Why?
Well, it's not as if you can just go to any translation agency and go, hey, can you translate our content into Irish? I mean, there aren't as many translators available as there would be for other language pairs.
That's an interesting, because I know there are translation agencies, and because of the official language status of Irish in the EU, I know that there are agencies and there are companies that specialise in translation of documents, etc., into Irish. So perhaps they're not as good value as the translations between the more mainstream languages. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, in a previous life, I used to be a translation manager.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, depending on how, there's a couple of factors that impact the pricing. It's, you know, how common the language is. So, say, French, German, Spanish, Italian would be quite common. And then if you go into more exotic languages, the baseline pricing goes up significantly. So, say, translating from English into Irish or into Euskara or Catalan or Chinese, it gets more expensive. Then, of course, depending on the type of content, so, say, legal documents would be expensive. Very technical or very scientific or highly scientific or medical would also be a lot more expensive.
I guess it's a question of supply and demand, really, and the more companies that are able to do work in particular languages, obviously, the more competition there's going to be between them. That's probably true as well. Let's move on, Michaela. We've got a lot to talk about this week. And before we do, briefly, you're back, as you say, from Brussels, but you're heading off again next week to Beijing, no less.
Yes, yes.
What's on there?
It's the ICANN meeting.
Okay.
As you know, the ICANN holds public meetings 3 times a year. They rotate by region. This time round, it's in Asia. It's the first meeting of 2013, so it's being held in Beijing. The next one, which will be in July, is being held in South Africa. And then the third one of the year will be held in Buenos Aires.
So it's join ICANN and see the world, really, isn't it?
Well... to a degree. I mean, a lot of people look at it and go, oh my God, he's off traveling again and he's going somewhere really fancy and exciting. But the reality is you end up going to a really nice place and being stuck in a conference room for like 8 or 9 hours a day, staring across the table at people you were staring across the table at in another location a few months earlier.
I was just going to say it's like a community of people who come together every couple of months in a different location, and it's generally the same people.
Unfortunately, there is a certain degree of that. I mean, it would be great to say, hey, you know, ICANN goes to country X, and therefore you get much more engagement with people in that region. And that's, there is a certain degree of that, but it's not as pervasive as one might like. So, for example, last year there was a meeting in Prague, which was absolutely huge. I mean, a lot of people came in from all over Europe. So obviously you'd got the Czechs and you'd got a lot of people on mainland Europe, you know, it's just a matter of jumping on a train or jumping in a car and you can get there. And the meeting in Toronto was also very big because you had a lot of the Canadian and Americans in attendance. But, you know, meetings in other parts of the world, you know, you will get more people from the region, yes, but not as many as one might like.
Anything of significance coming up in this next meeting, ICANN 46?
I expect there's going to be a lot of sparks flying because there's a lot of stuff going on around the new TLDs. The ICANN's new CEO, Fadi Chahadi, has announced April 23rd as this kind of magical date. And we made an announcement earlier this week. They're going to be holding a big event in New York. But the thing is, there's a lot of stuff that hasn't been finalized. And there's a lot of very heated debate going on around various aspects of the new TLD project and the launches. And for us as a registrar, one of the biggest things for us is going to be the new registrar accreditation agreement that's been under discussion and negotiation for the last 18 months.
And I think you were tweeting or blogging recently that ICANN have actually been sort of putting registrars under pressure to sign up to this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, their view is that if you want to sell new TLDs, so these new domain extensions, so let's say .book or .dot, I don't know, there's so many different ones, .ninja, you will need to be accredited under the 2013 contract. The problem, of course, is the 2013 contract doesn't exist at the moment. It's still being negotiated. So they're putting a lot of pressure on us to finalize the negotiations and to agree to contract language, which will be binding on us. And, you know, with this agreement on a lot of things, there's several issues that still are being discussed and debated. And, you know, just putting a gun to our heads isn't exactly constructive, I suppose.
We'll talk about it some more next week, Michaela. I know that I think we'll have another chance to record before you head for Beijing, and we'll try and get maybe a podcast recorded while you're there as well. But to some of the news that's been happening in the last couple of weeks and perhaps in the last couple of days as well, there's a great big cyber war going on, Michaela. I knew nothing about it.
Yeah, this is one of these things. There's been a lot of media coverage about this over the last few days. BBC, I think you put in a link there to QZ.com, another one to BusinessPost.ie.
Fill it in the background for us here, Michaela. There are two companies here, and they've decided to basically one is attacking the other with distributed denial of service attack or something?
Well, yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, what you may have heard of Spam House. Spam House is a voluntary project. It's a big blacklist. And what they do there is they maintain blacklists of IP addresses, domain names, and groups and criminal organizations that abuse the internet. I mean, you know, sending out massive amounts of spam that are using domain names for spreading all sorts of other rubbish around the internet. I mean, we're talking, you know, malware, all this kind of thing. And a lot of ISPs and hosting providers, including ourselves, would use the Spam House blacklists to help reduce the amount of junk hitting our users' mailboxes.
I'm looking at their listing on their sponsors page. You're listed among, Black Knight is listed among the sponsors, among the many sponsors of the Spam House project.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we host a public mirror for Spam House.
Okay.
I mean, it's in line with the kind of stuff we do. I mean, a lot of the stuff we do, Con, it's to kind of improve the ecosystem, as it were. You know, we take a very firm line on spam and always have. We take a very firm line on other forms of abuse, and we take a very firm line on cybercrime in general. So the guys in Spam House, they do a very good job of blacklisting all this junk. And there's several hosting providers out there that are what one might call bulletproof hosting. And the idea behind bulletproof hosting is that it's hosting that is specialized in providing services to spammers, basically. These are companies that, you know, if you go and search for bulletproof hosting, you'll find companies listing services saying, you know, they will ignore all the takedown notices. They'll be able to give you new IP addresses on a regular basis. If your IP address gets blacklisted, they'll give you a new one. All this kind of thing. Now, the entity that's behind all these attacks, seemingly, is a lot in Holland called Cyberbunker. Mm-hmm. And Cyberbunker, again, they claim that they will host pretty much anything. I think there's maybe two exceptions. They won't do child porn, and they won't do. And I can't remember what the other thing was. I think child porn was the main thing. And they seem to have been behind a massive attack on the main Spam House website.
So Spam House had put Cyberbunker's host or put some of their IP addresses on a blacklist. Was this
all of their IP addresses?
Okay, because of the fact that Spam House, doing its job, identified that spam was coming from these IP addresses, and so the likes of you and others who use the Spam House blacklist would have been blacklisting these IP addresses. Is that the case?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, basically, any SMTP traffic, in other words, email coming from an IP address in Spam House, would be dropped by a lot of companies, including ourselves.
An IP address at Cyberbunker, you mean?
An IP address in the Spam House blacklist.
Of course, yeah. Okay. So in this case, these guys at Cyberbunker have decided to launch a DDoS attack against Spam House. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is normal. I mean, this happens on a regular basis that, you know, the miscreants, as some people like to call them, they get upset with the blacklist providers, and so they try to strike back by launching some kind of denial of service attack. The difference this time round was that the attack was bigger, and there have been mixed reports about both the methodology used. It's not your standard DDoS. It's a DNS amplification attack.
Okay.
Now, I'm not as expert in this now as some people would be. Mm. So, I mean, I actually gave you a link there to a video interview with one of the guys from Packet Clearinghouse,
which I haven't watched, but we'll post it.
Now, I mean, the basic idea here is that you're using, it's a reflection. You're using you tell a DNS server that you are a particular thing, and ask it a question, which gives back a very large answer. So what we're talking about here is packets of data. Mm. And what you try to do is, by abusing the system, you turn small packets of data into much bigger packets of data. I think it's probably not the best explanation in the world, but that's kind of what they're doing. It's one of these things that, it got a lot of media attention, but if you look at a lot of the reports, you'll also see that it's questionable whether or not the impact on this is as big as some media outlets are reporting.
Looking at that QZ.com, the headline, "The biggest cyber attack in the history of the internet is happening right now." And as I said, I hadn't noticed it. The other link I posted there in our notes, Michele, is to Daily Business Post article by Adrian Weckler, who reports that it really hasn't impacted anything in Ireland. There was some suggestions that it might impact, for example, people watching Netflix movies and things like that. I sat down to watch a couple of episodes of The Tudors last night. No problems whatsoever there.
Well, this is it. I mean, it's one of these things, like, some people there's been a lot of media coverage about this. The QZ.com article is just one of... I was looking at it, like, last night. I was on using Flipboard. I was just going through a bunch of different articles that were covering it. And, a lot of them were talking about it being, this huge attack and how it was going to grind the internet to a standstill. Mm. But the reality is that for a lot of us, we're not really noticing anything. There's been a certain amount of concern. I mean, I've seen emails on several of the technical lists where people are discussing the methodology that's being used, and people are saying, "Hey, have you checked your network? Is it susceptible to this form of attack? These are things you can look at. These are things you can do." Spamhaus were in contact with us as well and said, "Hey, this could happen. This could impact you."
Yes.
But as I say, we haven't noticed anything over here in Ireland. I mean, I'm not talking about just Black Knight, the hosting provider, but I mean, as a me and my DSL line at home type of thing. I haven't really seen anything, and I haven't heard any reports.
Yeah, and you've just sent me a link to a Gizmodo article saying that the internet war apocalypse is a lie. There's really no evidence that anyone's been impacted at all, really, by this. It is certainly, there's no question but that it is happening, but it doesn't seem to be causing the kind of collateral damage that people suggested. So all's well then, is it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, the thing about it is that the threats of these kind of cyber attacks it's growing all the time. It's not something that people can just ignore. And the real problem is the vector of attack. Mm. How various people can use systems to abuse the internet. So some of the attacks can be mitigated by people just applying best practices to their network, closing down holes that they shouldn't have left open in the first place. And I think, raising awareness of these real threats isn't a bad thing. But, the article that I just gave you a link to there, the one on Gizmodo, it does actually, it brings into question a lot of the media hype around it. I think it's a good article. It's a very well-written article.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about Cyberbunker. Let's talk about these guys and what it is they hope to gain from this, Michele. I know you've talked about this. It's a recurring theme on this show with us, and it's something you've talked about a lot, is, I suppose, responsible internet infrastructure, responsible internet service provision, the kind of things like that you're involved in and engaged with, such as the campaign against fake pharma and things like that as well. Your respective court orders and takedown notices and things like that. And as you mentioned, these other guys, Cyberbunker, have a very different view of the internet and of spam and things like that in general. You know, this is what are they about, Michele? And I mean, what do they? First of all, what are they about? What's their attitude? Do they have support out there? And what do they hope to gain from this kind of cyber terrorism, if you like?
Well, I mean, what are they about? I mean, how can I even? It's very hard for me to answer this without using a long string of expletives. So I'll try to be brief. Cyberbunker, just reading the Wikipedia article, which is probably the most neutral one you'll find. Cyberbunker, Dutch company, according to its website, hosts services to any website except child pornography and anything related to terrorism. It is known for allegedly hosting spam sites and denial of service attacks. Mm-hmm. And it's based in a former Cold War bunker.
Yeah. So, I mean, given that they've two things on their list that they won't touch, they do appear to have some principles. There does seem to be some ideology behind this. Is it simply, in your view, and you know, you can answer this any way you like, Michele, is it simply criminality, or is it a case of just saying, well, you know, we believe that information should be free, and you know, what have you, and that includes spam?
No, it's criminality. Sorry, no. I mean, there's no. This is very, very simple. I mean, I'm all for a free and open internet. I have serious issues with what a lot of intellectual property rights people might try to do just because their own business models are extremely flawed. I've issues with a lot of these things, and I will stand up and fight for that for all of that. But freedom is not the freedom to commit crime, and spam and other forms of abuse. They've no place on the internet.
No, and again, resorting to terror to tactics such as denial of service attacks and things like that as well, Michele. You know, that speaks volumes, I think, as well in terms of who these people are and what their motivations are. I mean, that's essentially it's aggression, I suppose you could say.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, the thing is this. I mean, denial of service attacks have massive impact on lots of innocent bystanders.
Yeah.
Bystanders, or can do, depending on how they're done.
Yeah.
I mean, reading some of the comments on the Cloudflare blog post about this, I mean, not actually the post itself, actually the comments themselves are quite interesting. Mm. The Cloudflare were handling some of the DNS for Spam House's main website and some of the other services. And it seems that the amount of traffic that the DDoS was attracting impacted the Links exchange in London.
Right.
I mean, the Wikipedia article there, it's actually not a bad article. I mean, they talk about, that it was peaked at 300 gigabits per second, whereas an average large-scale attack might reach 50. I mean, that's those kind of figures are quite realistic. But I mean, you have to put this in perspective as well. I mean, the amount of traffic that is actually going across the internet every second is huge. I mean, the Internet Exchange in Dublin is not one of the bigger ones in the world, but if you look at the traffic graphs there, during a normal day, they're probably hitting. I think the averaging was about 30 gigabits, mm-hmm. 30 gigabits in and out. with a max up to about 45.
Okay, let's move on, Michele. We've got lots to talk about on the show this week. And I'm going to move on to my new favourite tweet of the week, which this week is from Marissa Meyer. And it's for predictable enough reasons, as you point out, in terms of my own interests in that as well. I told you, I think, in a couple of weeks ago how excited I got. And lots of other people when Commander Chris Hadfield on the space station, when he tweeted Os Gaeilge. Now Marissa Meyer is at it, tweeting in Irish, to announce that Yahoo are hiring 200 people in Dublin. That's cool.
Well, that's cool. That's good news.
Digwit says her tweet, Yahoo is hiring in Dublin. We're adding 200 more jobs this year. And there's a link to the press release on that as well. And of course, lots of people replied to Marissa's tweet and said, yes, but will they be able to work from home?
That was predictable enough.
What's your policy on that, Michele, as a matter of interest? Or what do you make of Marissa Meyer's coming into Yahoo, taking over, looking around her and discovering that a whole lot of people in Yahoo were just phoning it in from home and not really very effective?
It's an interesting question. I think it depends a lot on what the people are doing, what role they have and whether or not that role can be fulfilled remotely or not.
I mean, you in Black Knight, you have people working remotely.
We do, yeah. I mean, I've got one person in Siberia, one person in France, and we have a second office in Dublin as well, where we have one or two people depending on the day of the week.
Doesn't work for everyone, so is what you're saying. I mean, it depends on the job. There's a lot to be gained from sharing an office space with people as well.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, as I say, it depends a lot. I mean, a lot of my friends who work in the internet industry work remotely, but others work in offices. So, you know, if I talk to anybody in, say, Newstar, you know, the registry for .biz and .us, most of them would be working out of one of the new star offices, be that in near Washington, D.C., or in one of the other locations they have in the States. But like, say, with some of the other people I deal with, because of what they're doing, they don't need to be in the main office for whichever company they're working for. Mm. I mean, it's very much a case of you know, what your role is. I mean, I was actually tweeting with the former CEO of GoDaddy about this the other week, and he made an interesting comment. He says, you know, if all your workers are remote workers, then you really don't have a company. You have a set of consultants or something, I think was what he said, which I wouldn't agree with entirely, but I can understand where he's coming from.
My view of remote working, I think, and I'm not sure exactly, I know I read some article on this recently, which I have to say I agreed with wholeheartedly, is that remote working has its advantages and disadvantages, but in some cases it's more disadvantageous to the employee than it is to the company, in the sense that because you're not necessarily around for those water cooler moments, or, you know, you're not necessarily seen in the office, yet you are producing productive work. But the fact that you're not seen around means that you could end up being sort of skipped over for opportunities and for promotion even, or say for short term career advancing things which might come up from time to time.
No, totally. I mean, this is it. I mean, it's like, you know, if you're in the office, if you're with the other people, you can share experiences, you can share things much more easily. I mean, it's easy. What's actually said? Oh, here we go. When you have a large number of remote employees, you become a network of consultants rather than a company.
This is Bob Parrotson's, is it, saying this?
No, Warren Adelman.
Oh, right. Okay.
Interesting character. I mean, I thought that was kind of an interesting way of putting it. Mm. I mean, the reality is, I mean, for a lot of the staff we have, they need to be together. I mean, they need to be in close proximity, because I just don't see how it would work. I mean, if you've got your technical support team, they need to be able to interact with each other quickly and easily. But I mean, at the same time, you know, there's several people who might be in the same building as me, but I wouldn't see them from one day to the next. I mean, I mightn't see them for weeks on end. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I've no reason to see them. I mean, that doesn't mean I'm not interacting with them. I can, you know, we can communicate with each other using a number of different methods.
Let's move on, Michaela. There's another good news story for Irish business this week, which I've linked to there. It's a press release from a Galway company called OnePage CRM. I don't know if you remember, Michaela, we talked about these way back. I just Googled it or searched it on the technology.ie website this evening. Back in episode 14, we talked about OnePage CRM. They're based in Galway. You've heard of them, or you've come across them, have you?
Oh, yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Again, it's they offer a CRM or customer relationship management solution designed for small businesses, really. And it's one I have to declare an interest here is in that I've been using it for my own business for the last year and a half or so, and find it very, very effective indeed. You know, a large full scale, if you like, sales management system that large companies use isn't necessarily going to be of value to a small company or to a sole trader. But this is really cool and really, really good. So I just want to say congratulations to Mike Fitzgerald and the team at OnePage CRM. They're in Galway. They have offices in Poland as well. And it's another example, I think, of remote working, because I was on their website recently and looked and saw that some of the jobs they've advertised are available either in Poland or in Galway, that you can work in either of those two offices. And this latest investment, led by Enterprise Ireland, is for €575,000, which will create 12 jobs in Galway, which is cool. All right. Let's move on, Michaela. Wanted to talk about now Veronica Mars. I stuck this in here at the last minute. I don't know if you got a chance to read up on this.
I did. Yeah, I was actually following that. I mean, I saw somebody, I don't know, somebody tweeted it or a link appeared somewhere. Mm. And it was about 12 hours after they launched on Kickstarter.
That they reached, about, it took them, I think, 10 hours to reach their goal, which was $2 million. They raised that in 10 hours. They've been about a week or two at it now at this stage, and they have now raised, it's now standing at $4 million, which is twice what they planned to raise. I presume the Kickstarter portion of it, I can't imagine that you could make much of a movie nowadays for $2 million or even $4 million. But I presume the idea is that that studios and other investors will come in along with the Kickstarter portion of it. But what it does really from the other point of view of other investors, and in particular from the point of view of the studio, is that it tells them that there is an audience of fans out there who are prepared to back this, who are prepared to put money into it, that there is at least that level of interest in seeing a movie made of this. Have you seen the TV series, Michaela? Do you remember it?
No, I never actually watched it. It's one of those ones that, you know, the name's familiar, but I never saw it.
I did watch it, and it was on some channel we had at some point, and I think it had already stopped production by the time I was watching it. I read here, I think, that it's 8 years, in fact, since the last episode of Veronica Mars aired. So it's about a college. It's a kind of a Nancy Drew kind of a one, in the sense that you have this guy who's a detective. And his daughter, who's in college, is works on cases and solves crimes and things like that. I think he's a private investigator. She is doing private investigation in her own right. For some reason, now I thought it was really good. For some reason, it was a real critical and fan success at the time. So maybe the two or three episodes I saw, I don't recall it making that much of an impression on me. But obviously, it did. I think they made three or four seasons of it, and now they've decided to make a movie of it. And this their Kickstarter video, their pitch video for Kickstarter was very good. I don't know if you saw it.
I did have a look through it. I mean, yeah. I just think it's interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about this on a lot of the film blogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people are really, really excited about it, but others are kind of going, well, you know, nice idea and everything else, but it's probably not going to work overall. I mean, it might work for them, but it's not going to be the solution to getting the funding.
For getting the funding for this project or for projects?
Or no, for funding in general, I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's clear. No, but it's clear. I would say, Michaela, there's no way you can raise enough to make a full-length feature film of a say Hollywood standard. $4 million isn't going to do it. But like I say, if fans put up that, you know, and then you get some other investors to put in some more, then it does become feasible, and you'll get those investors interested because they can see fans are interested.
Oh, totally. No, I mean, I get that. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think it's fascinating that you know, that they were able to raise that much money that quickly, and it's you know, the entire kind of crowdfunding concept. It's really fascinating to watch. You know, the kind of projects that are getting funding. I mean, it's, and you know, the number of them that are you know, they're shipping. I mean, they're sending out notifications. Their back is going, hey, we're shipping this now, and they're sending you updates about what's going on. So, I mean, I've backed a couple of projects, both on Kickstarter and on Fundit, the Irish one. Mm.
Have you backed the Pebble?
The what now?
The Pebble. Are you one of the people waiting for a Pebble to be delivered?
No.
I saw a few Irish people tweeting about that were waiting for their Pebbles. It's what? It's like a watch, is it?
It's a super duper intelligent watch thing. I mean, I think my sister was looking at it. I'm not too sure whether she did anything about it.
Yeah.
I backed a music project on Fundus. And I've also backed a couple of projects on Kickstarter. Now, I just think it's interesting, but it really does shake things up a bit. I mean, the idea of these kind of micro investments.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think about it, you know, you could launch quite a number of interesting projects, you know, for a few thousand euro, and get, you know, if you can get that money easily through something like Kickstarter, where you're getting hundreds or thousands of people just chucking in a few euro each. Sure, why not?
I think one of the looking at the I took a particular interest in the Veronica Mars project and read down through all of the different level of pledges and different rewards you can get for each different type of pledge. They often talk about in these kind of crowdfunding proposals that it's really important to get your rewards right, to have lots of different awards at different kinds of levels. And this is really well done, without a doubt. Lots of them very effective, very attractive. For $10 pledge, you get a PDF of the shooting script on the day of the movie's release. Additionally, you get regular updates and behind-the-scenes scoop throughout the fundraising and movie-making process. $10 isn't going to break the bank. You're not getting a whole lot for it. Further down, you get T-shirts, you get DVDs. I thought one of the coolest ones was where you get to be an extra. And there's even one with a speaking part. You get to be a waitress or a waiter in a diner, I think, in they're going to actually write.
Oh, yeah, there's another one where you could name a character or something.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And so, I mean, if you have the money for that, if you're a diehard fan, you're going to be really interested in someone of those. Invitations to the premieres, that kind of thing as well. It's $10,000 for the speaking role. And there was only one of those and it's gone. So somebody has paid $10,000. And the line is, you will get a speaking role in the movie. Here's the scene. Veronica is eating with the man in her life. Things have gotten tense between them. You are the waiter / waitress. You approach the table and you say, your check, sir. We guarantee you'll be on camera as you say the line. It's very good. It's very good.
I think, you know, there's... It's interesting. I mean, you know, if you're a big fan of something like that, be it a TV show or an actor, an actress, or whatever. I mean, you know, that's really cool.
It is. Let's bow our heads in silence for a moment, Michele, and visit the Google graveyard. Have you got the link to that I sent you? It's on the slate.com website.
Oh, yes.
Very humble, very, very solemn moment, really. And an astonishing moment as you go down through these various gravestones that are listed on this page. All of the different Google projects that have been retired or have failed or have been withdrawn over the last while. Google Listen, quite a recent one.
I didn't know what that was. I mean, what is Google Listen?
Google Listen is very simple. It's a... It's an app that for downloading podcasts. So it subscribes to RSS feeds and downloads their enclosures automatically. And the cool thing about it was that it integrated with another. I must leave a little flower on that grave. You click on the grave to leave a flower on it. It integrated with Google Reader. So you could, for example, if you came across a podcast feed you were browsing, say, in your web browser, you could simply subscribe to that feed in Google Reader. And if you put it into the Listen folder in your Google Reader folders, it would then automatically sync up with your Google Listen app. Great stuff, really. And again, as I said to you before, where RSS really makes sense for me is in terms of downloading those enclosures, subscribing to those programs. At the moment, I'm listening to stuff from NPR, BBC Radio 4 and Marion Finucane's Weekend Radio Show. And I listen to those, not when they're being broadcast. I listen to those by RSS. I listen to the MP3s that I've downloaded automatically of those. Google Wave is in there. Remember that? Google Wave.
Do you remember when that was meant to was going to change our lives?
I do, yeah, that's right.
I remember there was some amazing videos.
That was one of the most hypey launches of anything. I remember doing national radio interviews about that. Actually, people were thought this was.
I remember you trying to use it for a number of different things, and I remember all my friends were playing around with it and.
So it was pretty much unusable.
It had some wonderful options, but yeah, it just. Yeah. I think after the hype died down, it was like, well, okay, now what?
Down at the very bottom, then, in the Google graveyard, Michele, do you see the latest and newest grave? It's open, it's empty, and it's waiting. Have you seen that?
Yes, I think that's quite clever.
Google Glass 2013 to ? When will Google Glass join the Google graveyard? Speaking of that, I don't know if I put a link into this now or not into this week's notes, but it's shipping now. I think Google Glass for the people who signed up for the trial. It's US only.
It's one of those. The Google Glass has. There's been a load of talk about. Different companies trying to block people from using Google Glass in certain areas. And the privacy advocates are very upset about it as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
It will. Let's move on, Michele. Twitter facepalm moments. You've sent me a link to this. I haven't read it. What's it about?
Well, you know the way some companies do a really, really good job on social media?
Yes.
And you look at it and you go, wow, that's fantastic. Aren't they great? And then you look at some of the stuff other people do and you go, oh, my God, that is terrible. But this is a collection of some of the biggest facepalms that on Twitter. Like, let me see. Let's try to zoom in there. From Chrysler Autos. I find it ironic that Detroit is known as the hashtag Motor City and that no one here knows how to bleeping drive.
This is officially tweeted by...
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Let's see. Vodafone UK is fed up of dirty homos and is going after Beaver. These are all tweets
right.
from the official Twitter accounts of various organizations. And if you look down through them, I mean, some of them are absolutely terrible. Like Celeb Boutique, hashtag Aurora is trending. Clearly about her Kim K inspired hashtag Aurora dress. I mean, you mightn't recognize the reference, though.
I don't.
Aurora, it's from the shooting in the cinema.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. And it obviously clearly went over their heads as well.
Totally.
Oh, dear.
I mean, if you look at, there's a bunch of different ones, like 29th of August, which I think was during all the problems in Egypt. Kenneth Cole, millions are in uproar in hashtag Cairo. Rumor is they heard our new spring collection is now available online.
HMV tweets here. There are over 60 of us being fired at once. Mass execution of loyal employees who love the brand, including whoever's in charge of the Twitter account.
Well, yeah, that one got quite a bit of press coverage.
Because what
had happened is that it was a fairly young employee in HMV had been running the Twitter account for them.
Yes.
And got fired.
Right. So what do you expect?
She got fired, but they hadn't copped on that, you know, she had control of the Twitter account.
Yeah.
And, you know, had continued tweeting.
Let's move on, Michele. Black Knight deals of the week. Have you got anything in particular you want to talk about this week?
Well, we're doing a number of different things. I mean, we're going to be, hopefully by the time, back tomorrow or after the weekend, it depends on timing and everything else, we'll start offering the .pw domain extension, which is, you know, being marketed as professional web. But what's the kind of things that we're actually doing more of at the moment is we're doing a lot of these kind of combination things where, like, if you buy a hosting plan for a year, you get a big discount on a domain name. So if you buy one of our shared hosting plans, you can get a big discount on .us domains if you want to target the US market.
Okay.
As a business, not for individuals, unless, of course, you're American. And you get big discounts on .ie domains as well, and .co and .me and things like that.
Okay. So people can find out more at blackknight.com?
Yes, of course.
All right. Excellent. Let's move on, Michele. The next item just that I have on the agenda for this week's podcast is an article in The Guardian by Dan Gilmore. And it turns out I thought I was bringing something new to your attention, but as you told me earlier, in fact, lots of people brought this to your attention today because they thought the headline on the article was right up your street, and indeed the sentiment behind it as well. Why everyone should register a domain name. It's a no-brainer, I suppose, is the point of the article, and you'd agree with that.
Oh, totally. And what I thought was interesting is, like, just if you look at the first paragraph of it, it says, my students get extra credit if they can show they've registered an internet domain name for themselves. In any future course I teach, this will no longer be optional. It will be a requirement.
So the point he makes, Michele, and it's common sense, really, and it's something that people have spoken about a lot, is that if you're using, say, if you're hosted on, let's say, WordPress.com, or if you're using Tumblr for your blog or your site, or if you're using Facebook even, or Twitter or whatever, that's all fine and grand, but you don't control that. You don't own that. And if, for example, you breach their terms and conditions, you could find that a site on which you have built up a lot of if you like, social capital, a lot of followers and a lot of traffic, you could find yourself locked out of it. You could find yourself delisted.
Well, it's worse than that, Con. I mean, you know, things like Posterous is being shut down, or has it shut down already? I can't remember. I mean, you know, you can build up a presence on one of these social networks or whatever, and it could go away. Yeah. It could be taken offline. It could be shuttered. It could be a Google project, for example. You know, we talked about the Google graveyard. I mean, you know, social networks come and go. You know, we remember all the ones that have gone in the past. I mean, on the Google graveyard, they got Jaku, which a lot of us were using a few years ago. And if you'd spent a lot of time and energy building up like a following on it and everything else, hey, Google turns around and goes, right, well, we don't like this idea anymore. We're shutting it down. Boom, gone. Okay. If you have your own domain name, you can control a lot of these things a lot more. You can set up your own online profile. I mean, there's nothing wrong with using Twitter and all these other things, but if you don't have some kind of control over what you're using, well, as you say, you know, you could lose it.
I'm just looking at this link you sent me for the Star Wars Death Star Tea Infuser.
I love quirky.
$19.99, a tea infuser molded to look like the Death Star. Fill it with your favorite loose leaf tea. It's an officially licensed Lucasfilm collectible. We'll put a link in with the rest of the perhaps more serious notes we have on the show this week.
I actually ordered one, Con. Or did I? Hold on. No, I didn't. I didn't order that. I ordered the Star Wars Darth Vader helmet ice cube tray.
Have you got it yet?
No, I already ordered it today.
All right, okay. Well, send us a picture when you get it, Michele. So you've sent me a link as well. What's a Facebook like actually worth in dollars? So tell me.
This I thought was quite interesting because, you know, we're, anybody who's in business these days, we're being encouraged to market using social media. Hey, we do it a lot, and I'd actively encourage people to do it as well. But how do you actually work out how much is a like on Facebook really worth? And the article goes through a number of different studies that have been done by different companies over the last couple of years. And so it varies from, and this is what cracks me up, it varies from a high of $214 down to zero.
Okay.
It's just like, whoa.
Okay, so the zero, we'll look at that first. Forrester, the research group, says each like is actually worth zero. Likes are more akin to potential energy in an object that's being held aloft. None of the energy is valorized until something engages the object, which may then fall to earth, expending kinetic energy as it goes. That's a nice analogy for you. Some other ones saying it's worth maybe 21 cents is the next one up from that. Somebody else says it's 360, 22.93. Let's look at the top one. Who says it's worth $214?
This lot did a study of the 2012 nonprofit social networking benchmark report. So they're looking at the average value of a like for nonprofits seeking to attract donations, calculated based off total revenue received from a reporter over the 12 months following acquisition, was $214.81.
I'm not sure there's a correlation there, though, between.
No, I don't think I don't think it's a straight correlation, but at the same time, I can see why they come up with that. I mean, if you think about it in terms of, you know, if you're doing something where you're acquiring a customer, acquiring a supporter, how much that supporter is going to a supporter or a customer is going to pay you within over the course of a year or 2 years or 3 years. It's an interesting way of calculating. I don't know how accurate it is.
Here's the thing, Michele. I mean, I think everyone would agree that a like is worth something. You as a company have done a lot in terms of social media strategy. You do a lot to encourage likes and follows and things like that as well. You know it's worth something. I know it's worth something. The people who are doing the liking know it's worth something as well. They like to feel that, you know, they are in some way endorsing a company or a product or a service or an organization when they do that, and they feel that their vote is worth something here as well. The question is, though, how much is it worth? And what this article on businessinsider.com, what this article really points to is the fact that the analytics or the analysis, the people who are trying to actually measure this, nobody's got a clue here, Michele. We don't know. We know it's worth something, but we can't put a finger on what it's worth. Would it be fair to say that it depends really on the type of organisation, that it depends on what you hope to get out of it, I suppose?
Yeah, I think that's actually probably the best way to look at it. I mean, yeah. If you look at, Facebook. I'm looking at my Facebook stream at the moment, and just scrolling through it, I mean, sure, there's a lot of stuff from people, but there's also a lot of stuff from pages, and some of them are for profit, and some of them are not for profit, and some of them they're just for fun. So, like, there's one page I'm following, which is God, which is, it's not that religious, believe me, it's anything but.
It's not the official God page, no?
No.
Okay.
And, you know, so for example, they posted a photo, you know, and that's how Easter eggs are made, which shows a rabbit and a chicken getting it on. And that image has had 11,948 people have liked it. It's been shared 7,379 times. Now, there was another earlier this evening. I was looking at one of the advertising blogs, and looking at some of the images and things that, you know, companies have put out on Facebook and how they go viral that way. And I think, you know, there is a value there about getting a brand's name out there. But how can you actually convert that into money? I don't know. I don't really know how you can say, well, you know, that was worth X amount or Y amount or whatever.
In fairness, Michaela, these are the great intangibles. This has always been a problem for marketing and PR and all of that. I mean, how do you put a value on a brand? How do you put a value on goodwill, perhaps, as well, is another thing that's difficult to value. But, you know, ultimately people have to give it some kind of a value as well. So it's not surprising that there's such a discrepancy and such a variation among the various estimates. And I think, in fairness, it does depend on how you do your valuing and you do that basically on what you hope to get out of it. Let's move on. A couple of more things from the site, actually, at technology.ie before we wrap it up. Comreg have issued a warning about voice over IP phone hacking.
Yeah, this is actually a very serious issue. I mean, if it's serious enough for Comreg to care, if a lot of businesses, both large and small, are using various VoIP services, so you might have an asterisk box or something else configured in your office, because VoIP services, they can save you a lot of money. They can give you access to a lot more features. We use it, and unfortunately, a lot of companies don't lock them down. So it's possible for somebody to access it, access one of these services remotely, and, you know, abuse it and run up massive bills.
There's one case of a company being hit for over €30,000.
Yeah. Wow. I can well believe it. I mean, we had an issue with this going back a few years ago where I can't remember whether it was a case of a weak password or an entry point into the system which wasn't shut down as tightly as it should have been. And they managed to run up a couple of hundred euro worth of a bill over a weekend.
Wow. Somebody hacked into your... Somebody hacked into your phone system, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, we obviously fixed it. Mm. But, you know, the thing is, it is a real danger. It is something that, you know, it's like with, say, routers and things like that. But if people don't change the default username and password and it's accessible from the outside, that's an Aircom one. Oh, it's got the default username and password. Oh, excellent. Now I have full access.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of thing. It's a different system. And I think, you know, it's one of these things where people might not actually go back and check to make sure that they have actually, you know, change the passwords and login details.
Yeah, I can just imagine, because I know a lot of people who would sort of say, oh, you know, let's set up voice over IP, let's set up an asterisk server or something like that. And how does it work? Ah, I don't know. We'll go through the manual, spend a day on it, spend a weekend on it. And suddenly it's working and it's Monday morning. It's time to go back to your regular job. And isn't it great? We now have a VoIP phone system, PBX, set up. But guess what? We haven't really locked it down. And it's one of those things it's just, you know, goes to show, you know, you've got to keep an eye on this stuff. You've got to make sure that you are secure and that you update these systems as well, because there is a tendency, I think, with geeks to say, ah, it works, you know, let's move on to something else shiny and new. And the day-to-day dull work of making sure that you're secure isn't always sexy, you know.
The thing, Connor, is, I mean, yeah. It goes back to, you know, going back to, say, the DDoS problems and everything else. I sent a link, somebody sent me a link there earlier today. A lot of content management systems are being used for, you know, various forms of attack. And some of it's just a case of inserting dodgy links in there. And a lot of the times it can be for fake pharma.
Yeah.
And it's because what tends to happen is somebody goes along, they get a website, they get it set up, it's shiny, it's lovely, it's great, but they never think, oh yeah, maybe I do need to contract with these guys to keep it up to date for me. Mm. So, you know, plugins plugins don't get updated, there's holes in them, and people are able to take advantage of that.
We'll post a link to that as well. It's already on technology.ie. We'll link to it from the podcast notes as well on the website. And hat tip as well to IRIS, the Irish Reporting and Information Security Service, for bringing that to our attention as well. And to Comreg, I suppose, for sending out that warning as well. And finally, Michaela, the IEDR are at it again. What's this about?
The second time they've done this, they're running what they call the Optimize Fund. James posted something about this. They're giving away, well, it's for encourage Irish website owners or Irish businesses to set up e-commerce websites.
Okay.
So what they're looking at is giving about €150,000 worth of professional services to 20 different businesses.
That's a cool idea, and it kind of ties in with what we've just been saying, in terms of making sure that you have, an optimized and an up-to-date content management system. There's a lot more you can do with a website besides just having your basic content on it. You can have, as you say, e-commerce and stuff like that as well. This is going to help 20 businesses to actually do that.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. One more thing before we wrap it up, Michele. It's from the And Finally department. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this. Google gets the word ungooglable, or rather the Swedish equivalent of that, removed from the Swedish language. It's an interesting one for them. They obviously benefit from the fact that Google has become a verb and a noun and all kinds of genericization of it in a way, in terms, or is that the word? I think it is, yeah, of their brand name in languages all over the world. They benefit from the recognition, but it also puts their brand name at risk as well. They've got to be on the watch out for that. And in fact, the official Swedish Language Council had in fact added a new word to the official Swedish language, which was... do you speak Swedish by any chance, Michaela? No?
No.
No. Ogooglebar, I'm sure somebody would be able to correct that, but Ogooglebar is the Swedish for ungooglable. And it was, in fact, so noteworthy that the Swedish Language Council included it in its latest annual list of new words. And then Google said, can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the problems that trademark attorneys worry about. I mean, the genericization of your mark.
Yes.
It's an interesting challenge. I mean, you know, if your mark is really, really well known, which obviously would be the case with Google, it becomes part of everyday parlance. You end up with people using it as a verb. I mean, take the example of Hoover. Mm. It is a brand.
Yes.
But it's now a verb. And it's interesting because, you know, the Google gets them to not include it in the list of new words they're publishing. But that doesn't mean they that they can purge it from the Swedish language. They can't.
No, it doesn't. And that's probably fair enough as well. They're still protecting their brand name by actually getting it off the official list. But if people want to say it in common practice, it doesn't really hurt Google, I imagine. Do you think?
Well, there's an entire kind of thing about, you know, trademarks and generic words and things like that. I mean, I've been quite involved with some of the arguments around that over the last few months. I don't know what the actual answer to that is, to be honest, Con.
Yeah, it's a fine line, I think it is. Michaela, listen, thanks for joining us on the podcast this week. We'll get it out on Good Friday this week, and we'll do a recording next week as well before you head off to Beijing.
Well, hopefully, if we can slip it in there.
Very good. Thanks a lot. Slán go fóill.
Slán.